You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. I don't know, folks, if we're on WWCR or not. I do know we're on the satellite. Well, it sounds like maybe we are. Are we on? Okay. We were blocked from the satellite. Somebody had knocked us off the satellite and then called into the satellite and blocked us from obtaining entry. I don't know who. I don't know why. Doesn't make any difference. We're going to get right into tonight's show anyway. I don't know who you are or why you're doing it. But the only way you'll stop this broadcast is when I'm in my cold, cold grave. And that ain't likely to be anytime soon. Next week, ladies and gentlemen, all of the broadcasts, Monday through Friday, unless I get my business taken care of sooner, will be reruns. All next week will be reruns, but I've chosen some good ones, so make sure that you listen. Also, I want to let you know that in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, on October the 20th, and this is the only announcement of this you're going to get, so make sure that you listen and that you're there. October the 20th, 1994, in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, there will be the first meeting of the Constitution Party. The first meeting of the Constitution Party. It'll be at the main library, south entrance, located at 400 Civic Center. That's the October 20th, 7 p.m. at the main library, south entrance, located at 400 Civic Center. For information, call 918-596-7977. That's 918-596-7977. Anybody and everybody is welcome to attend that meeting. Well, last night I sort of left you with a revelation that many of you were not prepared to receive. And tonight I'm going to continue and back it up with a lot of facts. Remember, a lot of the meat of this little mini-series that we're doing this week comes from a book entitled Scarlet and the Beast, written by John Daniel. Scarlet and the Beast, written by John Daniel. If you would like your own copy, please send us $39.95. That's postpaid, $39.95, and we'll get a copy right out to you. Make checks or money orders out to Annie, A-N-N-I-E, and send them to the Intelligence Service, Post Office Box 1420, Sholo, that's spelled S-H-O-W-L-O-W, Arizona, 85901. That's P.O. Box 1420, Sholo, Arizona, 85901. 1-800-875-9901. Now, we've covered a lot of territory, and one of the points that I made is that the beast must resemble with at least 14 points exactly ancient Rome. So we'll begin tonight setting out some of these similarities between Rome and the United States of America. From 100 to 300 A.D., most of pagan Rome converted to Christianity. And when this nation was founded, 67% of America's population was Christian. Christians in Rome suffered severe persecution. Christians in America were fleeing European persecution. Rome, ladies and gentlemen, in its time was the melting pot of the world. And today, one of the well-known phrases is that America is the melting pot of the world. Rome was a democracy based upon a two-party system, the optimates and the populares. And the United States of America, they say, is a democracy. It was really founded as a republic, but today it is a democracy based upon a two-party system, the Democrats and the Republicans. Rome had a divided balance of power, the Roman Tribune and his Senate. America has a divided balance of power, the American President and his Congress. Rome was based on specific laws. They had 12 tables. America is based on specific laws, our Constitution. Rome protected the rights of its citizens. America, up until recently, protected the rights of its citizens. In Rome, all men were equal. That was the international law of Rome. In America, all men are equal according to the Declaration of Independence. But let me set that straight. All men in the Declaration of Independence were created equal. All men are not equal. And in Rome, all men, even though they said they were equal, were not. Those are facts. Look in history and you will see. Rome had a sordid history of slavery. America also had a sordid history of slavery. Rome was capitalistic. America is capitalistic. Rome practiced abortion as a means of population control. And the United States of America practices abortion as a form of birth control. Rome loved R-rated entertainment. Look at the history of Pompeii. And here in the United States of America, we protect R-rated entertainment under the First Amendment as freedom of speech. Rome had a welfare program funded by taxes. And you all know that we also have a welfare budget, and many take advantage of it. In fact, our welfare budget rivals our military budget. Rome had a thriving business in lawsuits. America also has a thriving business in lawsuits. Sports was Rome's pastime. And in America, football dominates fall and winter, basketball winter and spring, and baseball spring and summer. And I know some men who don't know anything more than the sports statistics for their favorite teams. And they think they're brilliant because of it. Ancient Rome's national emblem was the single-headed eagle pointing west. America's national emblem is the single-headed eagle pointing west. From 300 to 500 A.D., the Roman Church was weakened spiritually because of pagan infiltration. And after 200 years, the Church in America has also been weakened spiritually because of Masonic infiltration, which is nothing more than the ancient pagan religion of Babylon. So we have not only met 14, ladies and gentlemen, we've gone beyond 14, if you were counting. Most historians also attribute the name America to the explorer Amerigo Vespucci. Freemasonry, however, has a different point of view, and this will be new to most of you. For according to Freemasonry, and author Manly Hall, a 33rd degree Freemason, the Indians in Central and South America say the name came from their gods who were peace-loving. For example, the supreme god of the Mayan culture of Central America was known as Quetzalcoatl, a light-skinned god who wore a long white robe covered with red crosses. Carved in the stones of his temples were serpents. Quetzalcoatl was known as the peace-loving serpent god. The same god in Peru was known as Ameru, the god of peace. Ameru, the god of peace. He was pictured as a plumed serpent. Ameru's territory was known as Amaruca. Amaruca. The 1895 issue of the publication called Lucifer, a periodical published by Freemason Blavatsky's Theosophical Society, states this, quote, "From the latter comes our word America. Amaruca is literally translated land of the plumed serpent. The priests of this god of peace once ruled the Americas. All the red men who have remained true to the ancient religion are still under his sway." And according to author William T. Still, Manly Hall claims that since the serpent is frequently symbolic of Lucifer, it is no exaggeration to extrapolate from this that America may well mean, quote, land of Lucifer, end quote. We already have discussed the hierarchy in Freemasonry and that they consider Lucifer to be the good, benevolent, and peace-loving God. Their philosophy is known as the Luciferian philosophy. And it goes something like this. Man was held prisoner by an unjust, vindictive, and jealous God in the Garden of Eden. He was bound in the chains of ignorance. Man was set free by Lucifer through his agent Satan when man was given the gift of intellect. And through the use of this intellect, man himself will become God. That is the Luciferian promise, the promise of Satan to Eve in the Garden of Eden. Now remember, these are all metaphors. I don't believe for 1 minute that there was a naked man and woman standing by a tree and a snake came up and talked to them. These are substitutes, symbols for something much, much deeper. Much deeper. America is known as the good, benevolent, and peace-loving nation. We've also discussed the seal of the Illuminati, the unfinished pyramid. Its capstone and its all-seeing eye represents the kingdom of Lucifer. The image of this Luciferian masterpiece makes up half of the great seal of the United States of America. Just look at a $1 bill. And Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 12, tells us that Lucifer was the epitome of beauty. America, the beautiful, may therefore be a sinister figure of speech for Lucifer, the beautiful. Freemason Manly P. Hall states that when Atlantis died, so did the ideal pattern of government. According to Hall, the League of Ten Kings is part of the secret doctrine preserved by secret societies through their oral traditions. Hall believes that when the unifying force of the Ten Kings was broken, destruction automatically followed. So complete was this destruction, he writes, that men forgot there is a better way of life and accepted the evils of war and crime and poverty as inevitable. The old Atlantis is gone, dissolved in a sea of human doubts, but the philosophical empire would come again as a democracy of wise men. This connects directly with the protocols of the wise men of Sion. Freemasonry planned long ago to philosophically raise Atlantis out of the sea, and in this new land reestablish democracy as a new world order, Novus Ordo Cyclorum. Masonic author George H. Steinmetz confirms in Freemasonry its hidden meaning, that the democratic philosophy of Freemasonry has been traced back to the lost continent of Atlantis. He attempts to prove that Atlantis was a Masonic society by suggesting that the destroyed temples of Upper Egypt are all part of that Atlantean destruction. There, in Egypt, we find their ruined temples, which compared with our lodge rooms have similar floor plans, the same dark north, and many of the same emblems. And remember, in The Lion King, to the north was darkness and desolation. Finally, Steinmetz says that one cannot understand the universality of Freemasonry without accepting the Atlantean account. Hall concurs. Masonry is a university teaching the liberal arts and sciences of the soul to all who will attend to its words. It is a shadow of the great Atlantean mystery school which stood with all its splendor in the ancient city of the Golden Gates, where now the turbulent Atlantic rolls in unbroken sweep. And I bet you wondered why they named the bridge in San Francisco the Golden Gate Bridge. Now you know. Hall suggests that the antediluvian civilization was democratic, that Freemasonry planned over three centuries ago to recreate a universal democratic society that will philosophically rise up out of the sea, and like Atlantis, join with 10 kings to lead mankind in the pursuit of universal happiness. And what is the sea? Remember, the sea is the mass of humanity, great numbers of people. To rise up out of the sea is to establish through revolution. And that's coming. He says that the Christian church has delayed the search for the new Atlantis, and that's why they hate Christians, and Christians, like Orthodox Jews and the followers of the Prophet Muhammad, are scheduled for extermination in the New World Order. And he alludes to the ancient Roman Empire as the last attempt at resurrection of the Atlantean project, and states that another attempt would be made. Now we can see how Freemasonry's planned resurrection of Atlantis correlates with Daniel's prophecy of a revived Roman Empire. Likewise, John's vision of the beast with 10 horns, representing 10 kings, is more significant in this regard, given the fact that Freemasonry calls for its one-world government to be patterned after the Atlantean League of 10 kings. Therefore, to locate the headquarters of Freemasonry's new philosophical Atlantis, Daniel's revived Roman Empire, and John's beast, we must search for a land that meets the following requirements. 1. If old Atlantis was democratic, then new Atlantis will be democratic and most likely be born of Templar French Freemasonry, the father of modern socialism. 2. John's beast and Freemasonry's philosophical Atlantis will figuratively rise up out of the sea in the Atlantic Ocean, somewhere west of the Straits of Gibraltar, where old Atlantis was alleged to have sunk, and will be established through revolution from out of the masses of people. 3. If resurrected west of the Straits of Gibraltar, Daniel's revived Rome will be a new land in a new world populated from the territory of the old Roman Empire. 4. Daniel's uncivilized beast will be born in an uncivilized western land bordered by water, from Daniel's vantage point at Babylon, a land in the extreme west. 5. John's beast will eventually unite with 10 kings, as did old Atlantis, or will be divided into 10 regions, according to the plan or the world model of the Club of Rome. And on its model, the world will also be divided into 10 regions. Unlike Edgar Cayce, Manly P. Hall is not looking for ancient Atlantis to literally rise out of the sea, and neither am I, and neither should you, but I know that some of you, at least, have, are, and will continue to look for the sea as the literal source of the rising of a new landmass, which will be called Atlantis. And you don't understand the symbology, the metaphors. You are looking at the exoteric. You are the sheeple. Manly P. Hall, rather, looks to America as the nation that will represent philosophical Atlantis, and so do I. And through my studies, I know for a fact that this is it. For they have made the omission over and over and over again in their writings, the esoteric writings of the secret societies, all of them. And America's assignment with destiny Mammy P. Hall writes, quote, "The explorers who opened the new world operated from a master plan and were agents of rediscovery rather than discoveries," end quote. And when Columbus landed upon the beach, instead of planting the flag of Spain, whom he was supposed to represent in his discovery, instead, ladies and gentlemen, this great explorer, who instead of carrying the cross of Christianity upon the sails of his ship, carried the cross, the red cross of the Knights Templars, planted a green flag with a white cross. In a second book called The Secret Destiny of America, Manly P. Hall claims that the unifying goal of ancient secret societies was to create a new Atlantis beyond the Atlantic Ocean in what is now called America. The bold resolution, he said, was that this Western continent should become the site of the philosophic empire. Still explains that America, according to this great plan, was to become the first nation to begin to establish a universal democracy or world commonwealth of nations. This quest was said to be the most noble pursuit to which a man could devote himself. And ladies and gentlemen, I would have to agree with that statement if it were done honestly and openly and for the noble purpose for which they claim. But we know that it is built upon lies and deception and manipulation, and that the men bringing it about, and it is all men, ladies, believe me, there are ladies working toward this goal, but men rule the roost, I can assure you. They do not practice what they preach. They are liars, deceivers, and manipulators. And there is nothing noble about the goal of these scum. The first modern philosopher to promote America as the new Atlantis was Sir Francis Bacon, who lived from 1561 to 1626. He was an English lord and Zionist Rosicrucian. As an occultist well versed in the Great Plan, also known as the Enterprise, Bacon concealed the secret doctrine in a novel entitled New Atlantis, in which he laid out the plan for a utopian society to be built on this newly discovered continent. Masonic authors Marie Bauer Hall and Manly P. Hall respectively say of Bacon, and I quote, "Bacon is the founder of Freemasonry, the guiding light of the Rosicrucian order, the members of which kept the torch of true universal knowledge, the secret doctrine of the ages, alive during the dark night of the Middle Ages. Bacon had been initiated into the new liberalism represented throughout Europe by secret societies of intellectuals dedicated to civil and religious freedom. Later, when the moment was propitious, he threw the weight of his literary group with the English colonization plan for America, cherishing, as he did, the dream of a great commonwealth in the new Atlantis," end quote. Still, says Baconian scholar and Masonic enthusiast Marie Bauer Hall, believes this great plan has been perpetuated by an international group of only the highest initiates of the secret societies, as I have revealed to you over the years. Don't go away. I'll be right back. Thank you. Saturnitas.
Saturnine.
Fraternitas Rex Mundi.
Freemasons. Do as thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law. O-T-O. The golden dawn. Fascinatus wrote by Kushan. Ordo Fraternitas Saturnine.
Ladies and gentlemen, the hour of the time is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. They specialize in non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets. Please call them and discuss your financial future. Discuss ways that you can protect what you have spent your life making through investment in hard assets. If you have some ideas, communicate those ideas to the specialists at Swiss America Trading. If you've never thought about or researched the opportunities for safety in the precious metals market, ask them for their advice. Ask them for their publications. Ask for a copy of their free newsletter and read it. Read it. Do it now, folks. Call 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did. And don't forget, all next week, ladies and gentlemen, will be reruns. Reruns. We will not be here live. And there will be no satellite broadcast next week. Everybody hear that? If you're listening on satellite, you'll have to seek out a shortwave radio as we have no one here. Carolyn is not here. Our new worker, Pete, doesn't yet know how to operate the studio. So there will be no satellite broadcast next week. And all the broadcasts on shortwave will be reruns. These episodes this week, ladies and gentlemen, come from a book called Scarlet and the Beast by John Daniel. Also from my research, the research of the Intelligence Service and the Citizens Agency for Joint Intelligence. We've seen how this international group of highest initiates of the secret societies has changed its name many, many times to conceal the great plan, the great work, the enterprise. Bacon was the first of modern philosophers to reveal this plan as a Masonic blueprint for America. The hierarchy in his day was the Priory of Sion, operating through the Order of Rose Cross and later the Royal Society, now known as the Royal Institute of International Affairs, spawned off of the Royal Society, which still exists. It's also known as Chatham House. It is the private club for British intelligence. It was then usurped by the Knights Templar, who initially operated through the Illuminati, then the Palladian, and now through Luther's Trust. Rosicrucian Sir Walter Riley, a member of a secret society named after Bacon, the Baconian Circle, began the British exploration in America in 1585, settling off the coast of North Carolina on Roanoke Island. His colony failed, and England did not attempt colonization again for a generation. Meanwhile, in 1603, the Priory of Sion lost Great Britain to the Templars when James Stuart, the 6th of Scotland, ascended the British throne as King James I. German Rosicrucians immediately went into action, founding Rosicrucian Freemasonry in England, then backing Cromwell to dethrone the Templar Stuarts. Many Protestants joined Cromwell's cause. Finally, in 1717, the Stuarts, with their Templar Freemasonry, were deported to France. During the on-and-off English Revolution that spanned the latter half of the 17th century, the New World was colonized by British and European Protestants fleeing persecution. In 1733, English Freemasonry entered America, founding St. John's Lodge at Boston. Boston, in effect, became the Masonic capital of Britain's transatlantic colonies. China, these lodges contained only 3 degrees. Now let me go through that again, just in case you missed it. In 1733, English Freemasonry entered America, founding St. John's Lodge at Boston. Boston, in effect, became the Masonic capital of Britain's transatlantic colonies. Between 1733 and 1737, Grand Lodge England chartered additional provincial lodges in Massachusetts, New York, Pennsylvania, and South Carolina, and these lodges contained only 3 degrees. Templar Freemasonry, having been weakened by exile to France, had no strength to establish a base in America. Unimpeded, English Freemasonry planned to inaugurate the great plan contained within her secret doctrine. Happily for America, most of the settlers were Christian. Hence, the great plan was forced to operate much more slowly from within the newly organized English lodges. Now, folks, one of the requirements of the Beast Empire is that it be a democratic nation born of Templar French Freemasonry, the father of modern democracy. Michael Bygant, co-author of The Temple and the Lodge, has traced the movement of the Templars to America. He discovered that Zionist English Freemasonry reigned supreme in Boston until a higher degree Templar Lodge was warranted in 1756 by Grand Lodge Scotland. And he says, quote, "There were thus two rival provincial Grand Lodges in Boston," end quote, says Bygant. And he further says, and I quote, "St. John's under the aegis of the Grand Lodge of England, and St. Andrew's under the aegis of Grand Lodge of Scotland. And on 28 August 1769, St. Andrew's conferred for the first time anywhere in the world a new Freemasonic degree, specifically called the Knights Templar degree," end quote. Shortly thereafter, another form of Templar Freemasonry came to America, the quasi-Jacobite Grand Lodge of York, warranted lodge in Virginia. York Rite Freemasonry created additional degrees in the New World until it reached the 13th and final degree, known as the Knights Templar degree. 13 is the number of death and resurrection. 13-degree Templar York Rite Masonry, having ceased operation in England after establishing its base in the New World, exists today only in North America. Michael Bygant was able to trace the Western migration of the Templars by following their esoteric number 13. As you recall, the original Templar order consisted of 13 degrees. The number 13 also commemorates Friday the 13th, 1307, the day persecution of the Templars began. In 1314, some books say, and the esoteric books say 1313, Jacques de Molay, the Grand Master of the Knights Templar, was burned at the stake. "Only in America," says Bygant, "has the Templar Grand Master received his most flattering and lavish public homage in the form of a youth organization sponsored by Freemasonry known as the Order of de Molay, which William Clinton belonged to." We have traced his evolution from the Order of Demolay to the York Rite of Freemasonry, which is the Templar branch, of which we know he rose as high as the seventh degree. The Templars also stealthily entered America through military lodges. Of particular significance are those chartered by the Irish Grand Lodge, which offered the higher degrees of Jacobite Masonry. Later, these lodges incorporated the French Templar Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, which then were known as the French Templar Scottish Rite degrees. And it further divided colonial America between two rival forms of Freemasonry. While British politics in the colonies was dominated by English Masons in the Northeast, her military was under the influence of French Templar field lodges throughout the colonies, not a stable union for governing 13 rebellious colonies. Another identifying characteristic of the beast's revived Roman Empire, according to our analysis of Daniel chapter 7, verses 7 through 8, in chapter 26, is that it must be populated by immigrants from the territory governed by the old Roman Empire. Of course, colonial America was populated by peoples from a Europe shaped by ancient Rome and later by the Holy Roman Empire. Templar influence in America began after Prince Charles Edward, the young Stuart pretender, failed to regain his British throne. As you may recall, in 1746, he was soundly defeated, forever dashing the hopes of Scottish Templars recapturing England. And as a result, many Irish and Scottish Templar Jacobites who had fought with Charles Stuart fled to America. Those who returned to France with the prince founded the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry. Between 1745 and 1753, the British and European Templar population in the New World had increased dramatically. In 1754, Benjamin Franklin attempted to relieve population pressure by proposing a plan for the union of all 13 colonies. The British government rejected Franklin's proposal, fearing a united America would be difficult to control. Subsequently, the exploring population was forced to move west into French territory, which precipitated the French and Indian War in America, a phase of the Seven Years' War on the continent of Europe. During this war, the French military brought to the New World the Templar Scottish Rite, first setting up base at Boston, then Charleston, South Carolina. Michael Bejant, in The Temple and the Lodge, explains, and I quote, "Prior to the Seven Years' War, most of the Freemasonry in North America was Orthodox, pro-Hanoverian, warranted by Grand Lodge London. During the Seven Years' War, however, higher degree Templar Freemasonry, by means of regimental field lodges, was transplanted on a large scale to the American colonies and quickly took root. Boston, the soil from which the American Revolution was to spring, exemplifies the process of transplantation and the friction that sometimes arose from it." Those who stuck to the British branch or the British Lodge became the Tories. Those who clung to French Freemasonry became the revolutionary Americans who established this nation. We know that George Bush and the Bush family belonged to the English branch of Freemasonry. And after George Bush left the office of President of the United States of America, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth II. Benjamin Franklin became a Mason in February 1731 and Provincial Grand Master of Pennsylvania in 1734 and again in 1749. In 1756, he was inducted into the Royal Society in absentia. The Royal Society, as you may recall, was an English Masonic front organization for the Rosicrucian Priory of Sion. Between 1757 and 1762, and again between 1764 and 1775, Benjamin Franklin spent considerable time in England and France. While in England, he discovered English Freemasonry's secret doctrine for America. Franklin was in London in 1775 when he was made aware that war between the colonies and Great Britain might break out at any moment, so in March he returned to Philadelphia. Later that year, he attended the Second Continental Congress, through which he helped draft the Declaration of Independence. In 1776, he was sent to Paris, where he came in contact with the Illuminati. Franklin learned of the esoteric significance of the number 13 and the Illuminati plan for the 13 American colonies. He stayed in Paris only a short while, returning to America with this important information. And on the afternoon of July 4th, 1776, he, with two other Masons, were appointed by the Continental Congress to design the Great Seal of the United States of America, which would include the seal of the Illuminati. And in the significance of that date, Osiris rose once again, was resurrected. The old dream of the Golden Age was reborn. Osiris, who was born in July, and in the dim antiquities of ancient history, was slain by Set, also known as Typhon, who was born in the month of August, was again born. Benjamin Franklin, with two other Masons, were appointed by the Continental Congress to design the Great Seal of the United States of America, which included the seal of Adam Weishaupt's Illuminati. Bajant suggests that Franklin favored the Illuminati plan to create a new world democracy, a philosophical Atlantis, over the British plan for an oligarchic expansion of empire. When Franklin was in France, he began to build a spy network in preparation for America's independence from England. And Bajant gives us the details. Quote, on 9 November 1777, a special committee, the Committee of Congress for Secret Correspondence, was appointed to establish a network of contacts among our friends abroad. Now, folks, our friends means initiates of the secret societies working in conjunction toward the completion of the great plan. This committee consisted of Robert Morris, John Jay, Benjamin Harrison, John Dickinson, and Benjamin Franklin, and this began the control of the intelligence community of the United States of America by the secret societies, which still control it today. It was to operate extensively through Freemasonic channels and to lead to the creation of an elaborate spy network. At the same time, and quite coincidentally, it was to overlap a British spy network which ran parallel to it and also operated through Freemasonic channels. Both networks were to be based primarily in Paris, which became the center for a vast web of espionage, intrigue, and shifting allegiances. End quote. Spying was not foreign to Benjamin Franklin. As Deputy Postmaster General for the American colonies from the 1750s until 1775, he became particularly friendly with his British counterpart, Sir Francis Dashwood, who moved in Jacobite Masonic circles. Dashwood also had Masonic friends who were staunch supporters of Charles Edward Stuart. While in England, Franklin stayed at Dashwood's estate. Michael Bajant gives us more details about the traditional role of spymaster incumbent upon postmasters general. And I quote, because it afforded access to virtually all letters, all communications, the position of postmaster general was also traditionally that of spymaster. And during the American War for Independence, their experience as postmasters general was to stand both Dashwood and Franklin in good stead. In his dual role of spymaster and colonial ambassador to France, Franklin established his center of operations in Paris. He was accompanied here by two other appointees of the Congressional Committee for Secret Correspondence, Silas Deane and Arthur Lee. Lee's brother was based in London. So too was Franklin's sister, who was also believed to have been engaged in espionage. End quote. Ben Franklin is often said to have been a Christian, but we know that he was not. He was also the master of the Lodge of Nine Muses in France. He lived with two different women out of wedlock and had several children who were in that day and age known as bastards. Franklin's sister introduced Franklin to the Howe brothers, one a general in the British Army, the other an admiral, both of whom belonged to Templar military lodges in the Colonial Theater of Operation. As Templars, they were favorable to the rebellion. And in fact, in 1781, the Howe brothers were accused of belonging to a faction which conspired to facilitate the colonists' bid for independence. In my investigations of all of these people, their membership and their involvement is passed on from father to son, from mother to daughter, throughout the ages. The Howe family, ending today with the involvement of Linda Moulton Howe in the establishment of an extraterrestrial threat to this earth. Franklin's Templar Masonic friends in the Postal Service and in the military also had Templar sympathizers in the British Parliament. And these traitors to the British Crown clandestinely raised money for the colonial Continental Army and remitted it to Franklin in Paris. Franklin passed it on to North America or used it in France to purchase arms and material. In 1778, Franklin joined the Illuminati Lodge, Neuf Sœurs, or the Nine Sisters, the Lodge of the Nine Muses. He rose to be the master of that lodge, and he assisted in the initiation of Voltaire. Later, he became Grand Master of the Lodge. In 1782, Franklin joined a more elusive and mysterious Freemasonic conclave known as the Royal Lodge of Commanders of the Temple West. So much for Benjamin Franklin. As stated earlier, the British spy network in Paris was also Masonic. Its agents had penetrated Franklin's operation by joining his Nine Sisters Lodge. Thus, the British government was kept apprised not only of the colonists' activities, but also of French plans for entering the war. British knowledge of the impending colonial revolt did not, however, reach ears in America, because the British colonial high command in charge of the Crown's army and navy in the New World, namely the Howe brothers, were Templar Freemasons solidly in the camp of Franklin. To guarantee the success of the American Revolution, the Howe brothers displayed dilatory conduct throughout the war. The War for American Independence was a continuation of the battle between English and French Freemasonry, the conflict over the control of New Atlantis. Originated in Boston between two adversarial lodges, Zionist St. John's and Templar St. Andrews. Among the members of St. Andrews were John Hancock and Paul Revere. To the south in Virginia were two other Templar Masons, Patrick Henry and Richard Henry Lee, who in 1769 prompted the Virginia Assembly to formally condemn the British government. Events swiftly accelerated toward open conflict between England and her American colonies. And in 1770, the famous Boston Massacre occurred when British sentries killed five rioters. In 1771, 13 rebels were executed for treason in North Carolina. In 1772, two prominent Freemasons, John Brown and Abraham Whipple, had attacked a customs ship off Rhode Island and burned it. In 1773, the British government increased the tax on tea to keep the British East India Company solvent. In retaliation, Knights Templar Freemasons from St. Andrew's Lodge, dressed as Mohawk Indians, after the meeting of the lodge adjourned, boarded the Dartmouth in Boston Harbor and dumped its tea overboard. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the truth about the famous Boston Tea Party that is said to have triggered the American Revolution. It took 3 months for the news of the Boston Tea Party to reach London, whereupon the British Parliament declared Massachusetts to be in a state of rebellion. Not realizing the significance of the Masonic division in the colonies, the Crown's action was swift and misguidedly drastic. the Boston Port Bill, which placed an embargo on all trade with Boston, for example, effectively closed the port and stiffened colonial resolve against the crown. On September the 5th, 1774, the First Continental Congress convened in Philadelphia to plan action against the British. The Congress was under the presidency of Templar Freemason Peyton Randolph, a prominent attorney and provincial Grand Master of Virginia. Boston delegates included Samuel Adams and Paul Revere. In February 1775, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress met and announced plans for armed resistance. Within a month, Templar Freemason Patrick Henry made his famous speech, "Give me liberty or give me death," to Virginia's Provincial Assembly. On April 18, 1775, 700 British troops were dispatched outside Boston. Templar Freemason Paul Revere made his famous ride announcing, "The Redcoats are coming." The Templar bid to take America from Rosicrucian England had begun. This war continues today. If you think you're on the right side, I can assure you, you're on the wrong side, no matter which side you are on. Each of us individually must begin to study, research, and learn the truth, and we must come out of Mystery Babylon and out of the beast. Seek ye the truth, and the truth shall make you free. It is the only religion. It's the best advice that has been given down to us throughout the last 2,000 years. It is the only thing that can bring us out. It is the only thing that can truly make us free. Good night, and God bless you all.
Slaves, row.